One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to The Game, the Aussies' dream of FA Cup podcasts. I'm Gab Marcotti, and I'm joined by Peter Lansley, Rory Smith, and a former pro who could never be tempted out of retirement, Matt Holland. Later on, we'll be discussing QPR and Neil Warnock, but first, we got to start in Manchester. Right, City and United, and before we get into the game, which had about a bazillion subtexts, there's something I want to understand. Aurora, you're very familiar with registration issues and technical ones. How is it possible that Manchester United could sort of say on Saturday, which I presume it was Saturday, notify the Premier League, hey, Scholesy's back, this is a squad number, but don't tell anybody.
Yeah,
can you do this incognito?
Apparently you can. That's what has been proven. He's been training with the first team, we think, for about a month on and off. And yet then suddenly he appears as Manchester United's new number 22, which suggests that the way it works is that, yeah, they will have had to submit a team sheet, a squad list, a notification of change. And as long as nobody asks, the Premier League don't tell anybody.
Hey, Lansley, I'm just curious about this. I mean, maybe it's my pathetic sports entertainment mentality here, but you're the Premier League. You're a commercial venture. This is a big story. I mean, this smacks of, like, I'm a big professional wrestling fan. This sort of smacks of, like, WWE, and when, like, the guy who's retired, all of a sudden, he's the new mystery guy who kind of shows up. Is, you think that's what the Premier League did and said, like, this is a much better story if nobody knows about it?
Well, I think the Premier League's priority in that instance was how they played it, and that is to facilitate the clubs within their regulations. I mean, I don't think the Premier League need to go drumming up any extra publicity, so I think it was up to Man U. If it's within regulations and they want to keep it quiet, I think that's their prerogative.
All right, well, we'll get back to Scholes and his performance, but obviously one of the big things early on was, which I guess to some degree changed the game, was Kompany's red card, straight red. Matt?
Was it a red? Is that what you're going to ask me? Well, I suppose it's the well-coined phrase, by the letter of the law, I guess it was a red card. Now, for me, I think it's very harsh. I don't think it is a red card. In days gone by, we don't want to outlaw tackling out the game, in my opinion. I mean, that's part and parcel of it. I think fans enjoy seeing a big 50-50 challenge. In fairness, Nani just jumped out the tackle. I mean, if that was me in midfield, I'd have wanted to make the tackle with him, Vincent Kompany, but Nani jumped out of it. He actually got sent off against Wolves earlier in the season for a similar offence. Torres, likewise, against Swansea. So, by the letter of the law, I guess the referee has got it spot on. I think the law needs changing. That's what I would say.
Okay, but hang on. Help me out here, though. All right. It wasn't two-footed in the sense that his feet weren't together when he went in. One was trailing. It wasn't studs up because he gets the ball with his instep. How was that? And also, I may add, I don't know that you said, Nani, would, if that was you, you would have challenged for the ball.
Yeah.
Well, I'd argue if that had been you in Nani's position, you would have been late to the ball and you would have clattered.
I'm not as quick
company.
As Nani.
Well, that too, no. Yeah. But I it looked to me like, Nani avoided him because he was second to the ball.
But Nani kept on running. Nani didn't even turn around and ask for a foul. I don't think Nani thought it was. Yes, he didn't go in full-bloodedly.
Yeah, but Lansley, as the closest thing to a qualified referee that we have here when Alisson isn't there, you should know that a referee's decision shouldn't be influenced by whether the players keep on running or appeal for a foul, right?
No, but it does tend to give a good indication of what everyone around thinks. I'm not saying the ref should be influenced by it.
Nani didn't actually see the challenge, particularly because he jumped over it. It was Rooney and Carrick behind who then have claimed a foul. Rooney saying it was a two-footed challenge and complaining about it.
He tweeted it again this morning.
I know they did, and certainly Rio Ferdinand has as well. Look, we've seen some tackles this season, which Lampard, for instance, where I think that was against Wolves, that was probably a red card.
And what about Milias, when Milias then goes?
That was a similar tackle.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly. So then you've just got to get the consistency, which always sounds boring when pros say that, Matt, but it's true, isn't it?
But the problem is, you taught in this Catch-22 where you need to have consistency, because otherwise everyone complains. But clearly, every tackle should be judged by its own merits. So Matt's absolutely right. According to the law, you take two feet off the ground, it's a foul. But you can take 2 feet off the ground and come up with a perfectly safe tackle, just as you can go in with, you know, 1 foot and try and mutilate someone's leg. So it's this weird sort of tension between needing to have a rule, but at the same time needing to have it flexible enough so that referees can take into account what actually happens, such as if he gets the ball.
Now, what struck me too is a lot of people go and pointed out, oh, but so early in the game. Now,
yeah,
to me, it shouldn't have made any kind of difference when it happens. I don't buy the spoil the game argument. You know, that's the excuse Howard Webb used for turning the World Cup final into a bloodbath.
Time of the game is absolutely irrelevant. It's the situation and how it happens. You know, it's like the reputation one as well on the red cards recently that haven't been given. So Frank Lampard's against Wolves, where
not that sort of player.
He's not that sort of player.
Oh, my goodness.
He's not that sort of player. But it's still, I'm sorry, it's still a reckless challenge, and it's a red card. Joey Barton, he is that type of player. Oh, it's a red card.
You were not that sort of player. Did you avoid a couple red cards because you were not that sort of player?
Great question, and I'll tell you what, I did actually. I did get away with one at Sunderland.
Was it Cattermole? Was it somebody?
No, it was Alex Ray.
Ooh.
Yeah, so it was a 50-50 challenge, and it was one where I probably went a little bit over the top of the ball.
Did he curse at you in Scottish?
He was on the floor writhing in agony at the time. And I got a yellow card, and quite honestly, I probably deserved a red card. Peter Reid after the game was brilliant in the press conference and defending me. He's not that sort of player. but I did get away with it, definitely.
There you go. We have evidence that this...
It's a confession. It's interesting that that's obviously still haunting Matt Holland's dreams.
It's funny because I was talking to my brother about it the other day. Just on the back of the Barton incident, the Lampard incident, he reminded me actually of the incident at Sunderland where I made that tackle and perhaps should have been sent off.
Now, I was looking at, going back to the game, I was looking at the outcome, and I was sort of thinking to myself, you know, for both of these clubs, is the glass half full? Is it half empty? And I thought, hey, maybe this is one of those games where actually both clubs can take more positives than negatives out of it in terms of the result. Obviously, for City, losing company for four games is going to be a big blow. And I want to get your views on this, because I want to start with United, because obviously they lost two in a row. They win away from home against a crosstown rivals. They're through the next round of the FA Cup. That's all very big. But then, of course, they had that second half performance. And I saw Sir Alex talking after the game, and he almost seemed angrier than he did when they lost the two matches before. Rory, are you with Sir Alex? Should he be angry and throwing teacups even after this victory? I mean, were they that bad in the second half?
No, it was a 3-0 up performance, wasn't it? It was just they played like a team who had won the game, and you know, ultimately they almost sort of got caught out for that. But I do think that psychologically, you're 3-0 up at half time against a team who beat you 6-1 at home the previous time you met. They will have wanted to go and sort of do to City what City had done to them, and the fact that they didn't, even against 10 men, it looked, watching it from the David Seaman suite at London Road in Peterborough, it looked to me a little bit like confirmation that the power shifted, that City don't buckle in the way that United did against, you know, when the circumstance was roughly similar. So to me, I think despite defeat, City can take positives, and United, there is a negative there.
I think on reflection, Sir Alex Ferguson would be delighted with the result yesterday. They were absolutely awful at Newcastle. They were out out-muscled, out-fought, out-battled, all the things that you don't expect from a Manchester United side. And against City, they had to put that right. On reflection, looking at it, they've beaten their nearest rivals, who are 3 points ahead of them in the title race, and have the perhaps the stronger squad and have the better running and look favourites for the title. And they're through to the next round of the FA Cup. If you'd have said on the back of two defeats and two poor defeats, Blackburn at home and Newcastle away, you're going to go to City and you're going to be 3-0 up at half time. Okay, they're going to come back strong in the second half, which you would have expected anyway. You're into the hat for the next round. I think you'd be absolutely delighted this morning.
Okay, so you're contradicting Sir Alex, who's...
I think he was obviously angry.
He sets the bar very high.
He was angry post-match, and it's letting the players know that they can't drop their standards, which they did in the matches against Blackburn and Newcastle.
And it's probably heat of the moment as well, yeah. A little bit, because by today he'll look at the draw and he'll look at the victory, and I think he'll be, as Matt says, taking the positives more as time goes by.
Yeah, see, I mean, I can buy the positives if they've interrupted the run, but... Goodness me, it's 45 minutes against 10 men, you know, was... And you lose 2-0. I mean,
you can't hide there's problems. You can't hide that there's problems at United, definitely. I mean, the spine of the team, even central midfield, still there's an issue. I know he's brought Paul Scholes back in because they're lacking numbers in that area. The fact that Vidic is out for the season is a massive blow for them because he's their best defender, probably their best player at the moment, alongside Wayne Rooney. The goalkeeper issue is still ongoing. Still no further knowing who's the better of the two, really. You know, David De Gea has made some high-profile mistakes. Lindegaard looked calm and composed and assured, but not really being tested. Yesterday makes a mistake in a high-profile game where he looked nervous and on edge. I even think the first goal he perhaps should have got across to the Kolarov free kick better than he did. So that's the problem for them. There's no doubt there are issues at United.
But then you're Man City, and you've had this record-breaking start to the season. You've got the most expensive squad ever assembled in England. You've got Sergio Aguero and David Silva and all these brilliant players. And you're 3 points ahead of Manchester United, who are... I mean, I don't even think United fans deny it, particularly that they're a shadow. They're not a great side, United, and they're still there.
Mancini deserves massive credit yesterday for his tactical changes. I mean, in the past, you know, everyone sort of said, oh, he's assembled this great squad and he's spent money and he's got these great players in the team. But yesterday, tactically, he got it absolutely spot on in the second half. He shored it up at the back. He went to a three. He kept two up front, which caused United problems defensively. He took off his most influential player this year, David Silva, to do that at half time. So a lot of people in the past have just said, oh well, Mancini, yeah, he's come in, he's spent money, he's got a good squad, but actually I thought tactically he was good yesterday.
I want to get this out of the way. I thought it was remarkable, and I guess a reflection of the age we live in, that, you know, I'm sitting there Friday night, and I've got the Twitter open, and they tweet through the front page of the next day's Independent at just before 9 o'clock. It's that Nick Sutton, that Radio 4 guy, does that, and if you don't subscribe to him, you should, because it is kind of neat. And then, sort of within an hour, comes United's response to a story which hasn't actually been printed yet, because the newspaper isn't out yet. Nobody's actually read the story. I mean, there could have been quotes from Fergie and Rooney in the story. But and it's not just United, by the way. It's on United's website. I mean, you can go and check this out. I thought it was remarkable, because it's like a joint statement from the club, from Wayne Rooney, from Stretford, Rooney's agent, and from this guy called Ian Monk, who's like a PR guru, not my favorite person in the world, but that's a whole other issue. And then, of course, Rooney and Colleen then follow this up themselves on Twitter. Now, Rory, you know how the media works up there. Can I take it as read that United knew that this story was going to come, presumably because the Independent would have gone and checked the story with the club, who would have said no, and then they still went and issued their preemptive denial? I mean, were you surprised by this?
I was reminded of the times back in 2009, when every so often we'd get a story in the North about Cristiano Ronaldo having signed a pre-arranged deal with Real Madrid, and even before the paper was printed, United would have denied it, and they were really quick on it. And United aren't desperately proactive with the press. They're happy to let things run and not comment. That's their general stance on things. With that, they were really, really hot on it, and it's the same with this. The other thing that I would say, the story was written by Jim Lawton, the Independent's chief sports writer, who is sort of an institution of British journalism, who doesn't often do news stories. And I think that's telling.
And that's why United took it so seriously, perhaps. What I find interesting here, though, is that I don't know. I can't remember too many situations where they take this story so seriously that they all come out and they all sort of hammer the point home. It's all lies, blah, 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 everything's fine. I mean, a year ago, I thought it was different because obviously Rooney wanted a pay rise. Some of us conspiracy theorists also still kind of believe that Fergie was very happy to give him the pay rise and maybe was sort of secretly happy that this whole went to a breaking point and the Glazers cut a bigger check for his players. Sir Alex has never been against his players being well rewarded, the good ones. But were you surprised? I mean, what's your take on this?
I am surprised, but I think in the light of what happened last year, United would want to cut anything in the bud. They're thin enough on the ground in terms of, star, top players at the moment to have any more circus going around Rooney. There's been so much, what with the night out over Christmas, the transfer request last year, the post-World Cup hangover and all that preceded that. I think it's probably a case of nipping this in the bud. As Rory was saying, Jim Lawton's not going to be writing a news story like that without fact, without substance. So get hold of it now, kill it early. And it is the age we live in, isn't it? I mean, things are going to get more and more interlinked as things break. If clubs take it seriously, they're going to act quickly.
Well, it's the FA Cup this week, and it's all obviously dominated by Eastlands. So we're going to talk, we're going to look at MK Dons and QPR, but it's really about Warnock and about MK Dons, because frankly, I don't think too many people even saw this game. So it finished 1-1. It's going to a replay. Late goal from Helgeson to keep QPR in it, but Warnock is gone. Now, I want to start with you, Matt. Tony Fernandez tweeted that, it's a results business, blah, 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 and if the results aren't there, you're held responsible. And he actually said, I'm going to resign if the results aren't good enough at the end of the season. We'll see if he does that. Obviously, he can't really resign as owner, so I don't really know what his resignation would mean. Is it good that somebody else is given a chance? Or are you going to be nice and say he should have been given more time, blah, blah, blah?
Well, I actually feel that Neil Warnock should have been given to the end of the season. I honestly feel he deserved that. I think it was a difficult start to the season, whether the ownership, the changing of hands in terms of trying to get transfer targets into the building. He perhaps didn't get his number one targets and ended up with number two and number three targets.
Players do you think he wanted that he couldn't get?
Well, I think he tried to get Peter Crouch up front. He didn't get him. I think maybe Darren Bent even, or someone like that. They're talking about Samba again in January now. I think he deserved the January transfer window to try and bring in players that he has identified and till the end of the season. That's what I feel he deserved because of the record of getting QPR up. I mean, they were knocking on the door for year after year and getting nowhere, and absolutely nowhere. They brought Neil Warnock and he got them promoted, and he's got a habit of doing that from the Championship. Yes, his record in the Premier League, it perhaps hasn't been as good as it has in lower divisions, but I think he deserved the opportunity till the end of the season. He hasn't been given that. There was, for me, it raised suspicion a little bit when we saw this week some of the targets or some of the names that were being linked with Queen's Park Rangers: Christopher Samba, Andy Johnson, players that had played under a certain Mark Hughes, and it raised suspicions. So, look, I think he deserves the end of the season. He hasn't got that luxury.
No, isn't it? I agree with Matt. I think he probably did deserve the end of the season, but. So
can you explain this deserve thing? Isn't the point of
he got the team up?
Okay, but this is no.
What's the expectation for Queen's Park Rangers this season?
Okay, no, but
if they finish where they are now, that's a great
season. Forget the expectation, right? But like, being in a football club, it's not like you're married to your manager, right? If a better guy comes along, who you think can do better for your club than the guy you have, even if your guy's done brilliantly until now, don't you have to look at the range of options? I mean, isn't it legitimate to think that Mark Hughes might be a better option than Neil Warnock? And what you've done before shouldn't really play into it.
Yeah, Hughes is a more proven Premier League manager than Warnock, and you're right that there is a duty of care, I guess, to the club.
He's also younger, taller, more handsome, stronger.
I don't know. I think Neil Warnock's got a sort of rugged charm to him, to be honest. But surely the point of football is to establish whether the manager that you've entrusted with the reins, to see how far he can go. And January, is that really as far as Warnock can go?
I think to back your argument up, Gab, Martin O'Neill at Sunderland you know, he's a fine example. He's coming to the football club. Yeah. They obviously looked at him and thought he was a better option than Steve Bruce, and he's made an immediate impact. So to back your argument up, then, sure. But Steve Bruce probably was certainly given a lot longer than Neil Warnock was to prove himself.
And also hadn't achieved what Warnock achieved. Warnock brought them up. He did what was asked of him. And as Matt says, they're 17th. Admittedly, their form is dreadful, but they're 17th. If they finish where they finish now, then their job is done. And the other thing that I'd like to say, because I'm quite passionate about this subject, Mark Hughes is an overhyped mediocrity. If you look at the players he wants to sign, it's David Bentley, Samba, Johnson. There's one other who he used to work with. He'll be with Sean Wright Phillips again. He's just signing the same players again and again and again. QPR with Mark Hughes.
Those all those guys he signed at Fulham?
Well, he had Johnson at Fulham, Sambury had at Blackburn. It's just playing.
Why is he looking at David Bentley? All right, let me take a step back. Okay?
No offense to David Bentley.
I just want to get back to this idea that I don't know what deserving is to do with it. If you have a better option, if Jose Mourinho rocked up on Tony Fernandez's doorstep, or forget QPR, right? Talk about David Moyes. We all love David Moyes. He's great, right? Well, if Jose Mourinho materialized in Bill Kenwright's bed and said, "Hey, Billy, I'm going to go and manage Everton. You don't have to give me any money. I'll do it for free."
And is he going to do better than David Moyes on no money? Is he?
Well, put it this way: a lot of people think that they would because they worship Mourinho. I don't necessarily, but wouldn't Kenwright be entitled to say, "Hey, you know what? For the good of the club, I think this guy is legitimately a better manager than you.
In that bizarre, and he can do better." Bizarre image of David Moyes, of Bill Kenwright being in bed with Jose Mourinho. Yes, he is. But the question is Hughes a significantly better manager than Neil Warnock? Because Matt's right. It's going to be largely the same players. Where are they going to finish with Hughes? It's not like he's going to take him into Europe.
A word on MK Dons. Now, obviously, there's few football clubs who get more abuse because, for those who don't know, MK Dons used to be Wimbledon, and then the owner went and moved them to Milton Keynes, where there was no high-level football. I need to declare my bias here because my old boss lives in Milton Keynes, and is a big my old boss. I guess he's still our boss. He's just so far above us now that he's like a faraway boss, but he's a big Milton Keynes guy. I'm going to say, at what point do we forgive and move on and ditch this franchise stuff, especially since AFC Wimbledon are doing pretty well?
I already have. I think it's died down a lot, the antipathy towards MK Dons.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, they're a legitimate side now, and they've had some good managers. They've produced, you know, quite a lot of good, not Premier League managers, but, you know, they've been quite a good sort of factory for managerial talent. Looks like Carl Robinson, the guy who's there at the moment, is on the same path. I think he's still the youngest manager in England, doing a decent job. So no, I have no personal antipathy towards MK Dons. The principle behind the move I didn't like, but as you say, AFC Wimbledon are doing all right, and there was an overwhelming economic reason to take Wimbledon out of London, and it secured the future of the franchise, I guess. But who's to say what would have happened if they'd stayed?
I think if you're 20, I think if you're 25 or under, then you probably wouldn't even know the history anyway. Anyone over that, of course, would understand what happened, and you know, anyone that can remember the 1987 FA Cup final and this Wimbledon side that came from nowhere all the way through the divisions to win the FA Cup, that great story. I know Carl Robinson, and I know his assistant really well, John Gorman, and I think they're a great team. I think they work very well together. He's developed a fantastic playing side, the way they try and get the ball from the back. They've scored this season 70 goals, and they haven't got one player in double figures. It just goes to show the whole team are able to score from different areas. And I think they've done a magnificent job as a football side and a football club. Obviously, if you're under 25, I say you won't understand the history of it, and you just see them now in the sort of third and fourth place in League One, and they're pushing for promotion to the Championship.
Should we be suspicious of Carl Robinson because he spells his name like a German, even though I presume the guy's British?
Yes.
Just wanted to check that. You know, I mean, so always remain vigilant.
It'll probably help him get a big job as well.
Well, you think so? Is he been...
Carl Heinz Robinson.
Yeah, that's right.
Lindsay, you get the. I think you're. I like to think of you as a bit more of a purist and a traditionalist and a defender of the sacred flame than these two here.
Well, thanks for that, Gab. But I'm going to disappoint you. I think time has moved on now, and I think because of how well AFC Wimbledon have taken up the torch, I think that has helped heal wounds to a great degree now. And also, although Wimbledon were the brilliant story of it, you know, from Dickie Guy in '75 through to Laurie Sanchez in winning the FA Cup in what was it '88 or whatever, I think they were a relatively new club. It's not like it was Everton or Preston North End or something. And economically, the sense is now starting to come through even more.
Yeah, I think there's an argument this won't be popular. There's an argument that we have too many professional clubs in this country.
And I did say 87, didn't I? So I apologise to Coventry fans because they won the FA Cup in 87. It was Wimbledon in 88.
He makes a mistake, but then he corrects it and adds his own little nugget there. All right, we're shaping up more of a discussion than a debate this week. Our producer, Chris Skinner, asked you all to prepare with an interesting transfer-related anecdote or story, since Lansley is a last-minute substitution. I'll go to you last, Lansley, so you can prepare. But, Matt, I wanted to ask you a little bit. You've been transferred, I believe, twice, from Bournemouth to Ipswich and from Ipswich to Charlton, is that right?
Yeah, and I guess from West Ham to Bournemouth originally.
Right. So. Now, how does it? Can you just tell us from the inside? Like, how does it work? Does somebody come to you and say, "Hey, look, you know, we don't want you anymore," or "These guys really want you," or does your agent get involved? Like, sort of the technique. I think people might be interested in knowing, like, from the player's perspective. How much do you know and when?
Well, from Bournemouth to Ipswich, Bournemouth were in administration, needed the money, so I was obviously a saleable asset.
Plus, it was a big step up, too.
It was a division up. We were League One and they were the Championship, Ipswich, but been knocking on the door in terms of the playoffs. And I was a saleable asset, and they sort of invited bidders, really.
But did they tell you, like, "Hey, look, we don't have a pot to go to the bathroom in"?
Well, they were in administration, so everyone was available.
Okay.
So everyone was available, basically.
Right. You sort of expected that somebody was going to...
Well, you hope more than anything. I mean, I'd had a couple of reasonable seasons at Bournemouth and was hoping perhaps that a move might materialise, because obviously I wanted to play at a high level and test myself at the next level up. There were a few clubs that came in. Ipswich offered the most money.
So how do you know this? Like, did somebody tell you? Did you have an agent at the time?
At the time, I didn't have an agent. The PFA looked after me, if you like.
So did the manager come to you?
The administrator came and sort of said, "Well, listen, we've had a few offers. We feel that are derisory as so far." Eventually, after much to and fro, in Ipswich agreed a fee, but it took a long time. It took the whole of the pre-season, basically, and I signed about 9 days, I think, before the start of the season. But it had taken all that time, really, and I was on the administrator's door pretty much every day saying, "Come on, what's happening?" Because listen, I wanted to go and I wanted to try and prove himself at a higher level. Eventually, a figure was agreed, and George Burley and came down to meet myself and the PFA representative at Bournemouth in a hotel. We came to an agreement, and the next day I drove to Ipswich and signed. So that was pretty much that one.
And your next transfer, was that very different? Because obviously you were more
It was different, yeah, because, I guess, again, Ipswich were probably trying to get me off the wage bill because we'd spent a year in the Championship, not got back promoted after relegation, and so they were looking to release the higher
earners. Did you have an agent at this point?
Yeah, I had an agent at this point.
Okay, so he's the guy who made sure you got paid, unlike at Bournemouth where it was just the PFA and you were making a pittance.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I had an agent, and again, there was a couple of clubs came in. Portsmouth and Charlton were the two main ones.
Did your agent tell you, like, you know, that obviously
I had a phone call off the Ipswich chairman to say that they'd had offers, and I had a phone call off Alan Kirbishley to say would I be interested in meeting him and having a chat. Which, and I obviously had my agent as well calling me regularly, giving me updates.
And Ipswich were happy for you to chat to Kirbishley because they wanted to get the money.
They needed the money again. Yeah. So I guess both my transfers or my major transfers have been because the club have looked to try and get some money into the football club. I wasn't desperate to leave Ipswich because it was a club I was very close to. I'd been there 6 years. We'd had great success. Unfortunately, we were relegated and spent a year in the Championship. We finished, I think, just outside the playoffs. And look, I was 29 years old and desperately honest to play back in the Premier League because that's obviously where you want to play your football at the highest level. Fortunately, a couple of clubs did come in, and I sort of spoke to Portsmouth, although not as at length as I did with Charlton, and eventually agreed a deal with Charlton. The year before, actually, Aston Villa came in as well, and I refused the move. I didn't sign for Aston Villa. They'd agreed a fee with the club. I spoke to Graham Taylor on the phone, and I didn't sign, but a fee had been agreed the previous year as well.
Oh wow! So was it? Why didn't you sign? I mean, did you?
Various reasons, to be honest. I mean,
too far away from home?
No, not really. I mean, listen, if it was the right move at the right time, then I think I had a 4-year deal at Ipswich. I was 29 years old. And to be honest, Aston Villa offered me a 3-year deal. They offered me better money than I was on for 2 years and less for my third year than I was on at Ipswich. Right. So for me, I said, listen, if you want me to make the move, you want me to uproot my family, you have to at least match the 4-year contract that I was on at Ipswich. And in terms of wages, you have to sort of, you know, match what I'm on for the 4 years. They didn't do that. For whatever reason, and so that was perhaps the main reason why I didn't.
Final thing I just have to know about this is when you went to look at the club, like, you know, you see people like they go and they tour the training ground.
Yeah.
Did you do that at Charlton?
And
would that have
no.
impact?
I've been to the training ground
for you to say no because the training ground is rubbish. I mean, seriously, what is it, like feces coming out of the toilets or what? Like, I never quite, I mean, you always assume they're going to be of a certain standard.
I don't know,
right?
I guess as a player or whatever, you get a feeling, don't you? You get a feeling for a club, whether it's going to be the right move or not. You get a feeling for the place, you get a feeling for the manager, whether you feel as though you're going to be able to work with him. And for me, Charlton just seemed to fit. And again, I spent 6 good years there in a great football club.
As a player who didn't have many moves in history, what made you get an agent?
Well, because I think with the PFA, I think they try and work for both sides, if you like. I mean, you know, obviously they want to keep the player sweet, but also they want to keep the club sweet. So they're sort of batting for both teams, if you like, whereas an agent is batting predominantly or only for you. They're looking to get you as the best deal as possible. So in terms of then renegotiating my contract to Ipswich and getting the best possible deal, I mean, it's difficult yourself going in and saying, listen, George Burley, I am the best player at the club, I want XYZ. It's hard to do that. Sit in front of the manager and tell him what you think of yourself as a player. An agent can go in and do that for you.
It probably helps when you look at
the PFA. The PFA, I think, are looking at both sides. The club are then saying to him, well, all right, yeah, but we've only got a budget and we're whereas an agent is working solely for you and getting you the very best deal.
Right.
What if your agent, when you got the good deal, if he went in and reminded Uncle George about how much money Matteo Sereni and Finiti George were on?
He might have done. He might have done when he was having a chat about the next deal, yeah.
Rory?
I don't have an agent now.
Your transfer story.
Lucrative moves you've made recently, Rory.
You have made a number of lucrative moves.
I've made a number of moves, none of them very lucrative.
We're after a transfer story off you.
Yeah, no, it varies. Thinking about this, it varies from case to case, really. I mean, I was still working on Merseyside this summer when Sebastian Coates, that deal went through, and that was one that was driven entirely by the fact that in Uruguay they will talk about transfers. In England, clubs won't. They will not. It's whispers and sort of nudges and winks and off the record, the occasional off the record steer, interpreting what no comment means in what context. With Coates, when
so should you not be pronouncing him like, since you are a Spanish speaker?
I have a theory for why it's the name is originally Scottish, so it is his surname is Coates. It's just that the Uruguayans pronounce it wrong. Cultural differences.
I'm sure Holland is originally Dutch, but you don't pronounce. But anyway, whatever.
Anyway, yeah. So Coates, it was a case of speaking to a Uruguayan journalist, speaking to a director at Nacional, Sebastian Coates' club, and basically using his information to track the transfer because Liverpool wouldn't give anything. In other cases...
Why do you think they don't give anything?
I don't know. And I've always sort of thought that clubs should be a bit more open about transfers since they are using fans' money to do it to an extent. But then at the same time, there's loads of different theories that if you're public about it, that it raises the price, that it might alert other suitors, it might, you know...
Other suitors wouldn't know that.
Well, this is it. You know as well as I do that everyone in football knows what's going on in football. You know, if Man United are looking at a player, Manchester City know about it, then there's only so many top class players. So it's a case for a journalist of basically assessing the information you get and then sometimes plumping for what's most likely to be true, or taking an aggregate of what you hear, of all the lies that you hear, and sort of trying to gain the truth through that. It's a difficult process now, transfers, for journalists.
Well, Lancey, would it have been so bad in this case that Rory cited? I mean, if Wenger had said, yeah, we're looking at Scott Dann and we're looking at other people and we all know we can maybe use a central defender, we may sign one, we may not sign one, what's the big deal?
Yeah, you're bumping up everyone's potential self-interest, as Rory says. So, and also, if Arsenal go and say, yeah, we are closing in on Dann, then it might... you know, persuade Liverpool to take it more seriously. And then you don't want to be seen to be lying as well. And you can't always get all the future truth all in line. That's not a very good way of phrasing it. But, for example, one manager I know, whose name I won't mention, but if you'd had a good steer or a good bit of gossip or whatever, and you took this name after a press conference and said, Martin, can I just have a quick word? What about so-and-so? I've heard you've been linked with that. Is that he would not lie to you. And therefore, if he wanted to avoid being deceitful to everyone, you'd end up with a whole myriad. It would just open up too many worms.
It is interesting how you get information from various sources. For one deal to Liverpool within the last year, the information came from the press pack in general, from a rival manager who happened to have a sort of connection to the player in question. So it is the information comes from loads of different sort of, and as Pete says, it's often that not that it falls into your lap, that's maybe slightly underestimating what journalists do, but it comes not necessarily from where you expect it to come, because a lot of the people who were directly involved in a transfer, the club, the manager, the player and the agents on both sides, are the most unreliable sources.
In my experience, and I cover the transfer market quite closely, it's been about 10 years now, I'm getting old, but rarely did somebody absolutely flat out lie to your face, at least with me. I was kind of lucky with that. But when they did, you kind of made them pay for it.
Exactly. They get egg on their face, don't they?
And that's why managers very rarely will say, you know, something's black or white. The best example with the transfer market is Redknapp.
Yeah.
Harry Redknapp has his entirely own language of fluid truth. And it's... it's a remarkable skill, and it is with Redknapp with transfers is remarkable the way he does it. A mastery of language that I think is accidental, but it really is incredible. It's picking the way through the miasma of mistruth that he, and misinformation that he gives you, and it's a remarkable skill dealing with Harry Redknapp on a regular basis. I don't know how his players cope.
Tell you what, I am so excited for Harry Redknapp to become the England manager for that very, very reason. All right, time now for some quick hits. Liverpool win 5-1 against Oldham, but it was another rough 48 hours at Anfield. Rory, what would you rather pontificate about in the next 30 seconds? The alleged abuse directed at Tom Adeyemi or Stuart Downing's alleged arrest?
Stuart Downing has been arrested, along with his ex-girlfriend, who I believe is called Michaela Henderson-Time, who was on Wags Boutique whilst not being a wag. I don't want to talk about that. Tom Adeyemi, Liverpool are doing the right thing, helping Merseyside police. I don't understand why Liverpool are being criticised for doing that. The way they handled Suarez was dreadful, abysmal media management. They're doing the right thing in this case to assist Merseyside police and make sure the guy who did allegedly racially abuse Tom Adeyemi is punished.
I'm also imagining the people who identified him were people in the COP, therefore most likely themselves Liverpool supporters. After Landon Donovan and Thierry Henry, Robbie Keane is rumoured to possibly be the next MLS caffeine injection to a Premier League club. Lancey, how likely is this is this to happen? And also, like, does it kind of bug you that, you know, these people are under contract over there, suddenly decide, instead of my off season, instead of resting and preparing, I'll go and play for Everton or Arsenal or indeed Villa?
No, it doesn't bug me, and I think it's part of the MLS being able to sort of enhance their brand, and by, you know, getting a bit of Premier League spotlight on their star players, albeit for a couple of months. Robbie Keane, last I heard, very likely to happen at Villa. McLeish very confident, talking about, you know, when a press conference might be, etc. And I think he'd be great for Villa, and I think it would be a real shot in the arm. McLeish wanted him last year, came close to getting him if the Birmingham owners hadn't, you know, had been willing to pay the going rate. It's also cheap for Villa, relatively. If it costs $500,000 for 2 months, it might satisfy the fans for a little bit. And just on the field of play, I think he'd just offer the kind of spark which Stephen Islanders struggle to do very much. And I can see him scoring goals. I can see him making goals for Darren Bent. And who knows, if it went brilliantly, perhaps they'd talk again.
Yeah, he could be fantastic. He was fantastic for West Ham last year. Thierry Henry is back at Arsenal, at least through the end of February. Matt, he's 34 now. What can Gunners fans reasonably expect? And also, how does your game change by the time you turn 34?
Well, for me, when I turned 34, I went to centre-half. I think you don't run about the pitch as much, and you I reckon I'd still be playing now if I was 6'4" at centre-back. So that's what happened with me. I think for Arsenal, it's an absolute no-brainer bringing him back. They're in a situation where Jovinho and Shamak are going to the African Nations. I think at times this season, they have lacked some sort of composure in the final third. I think with Walcott one side, Jovinho the other, at times the final ball is lacking. Arshavin as well hasn't hit the heights the last sort of 18 months, 2 years that we saw when he first arrived at the football club. So for me, it'll get the fans excited. I think he'll probably play in that left-hand side role. He won't be the number one striker because we've seen the damage that Robin van Persie's been able to do the last 12 months or so. He'll play on the left-hand side. He'll do what he often does, cut inside, get his shots away. I think he'll add composure, he'll add excitement to the crowd, and it's a no-lose situation, I think, for Arsenal.
You mentioned Shamak going to the African Cup of Nations. I know some Arsenal fans who probably want him to stay there and never come back.
Gab, one for you. It's no real secret that Daniele De Rossi, who's out of contract in June, is one of the hottest commodities out there. Any clue what he'll do?
Well, he was asked about it after the Roma game on Sunday, where the fans gave him a standing ovation when he was substituted. Which, remember, this is a guy who never gets substituted, and he said, "I have a very clear idea in my mind what I'm going to do. In fact, every day that passes, it becomes clearer and clearer. But every day that passes, I also realize I cannot tell you." So I have absolutely no clue. I mean, if he is going to sign his new contract, you'd kind of wish that he does it and moves on. I can understand if he's leaving why he wouldn't come out and say it and then have to spend another few months there. But what Luis Enrique and Franco Baldini, the new owners, are doing at Roma is absolutely fantastic. He loves this team, you know, sort of in a Matt Letizia, Alan Shearer-esque type of way. You kind of want him to stay. By the same token, the dude's what, 26, 27 years old. He speaks English. He's an absolute monster in midfield, and you can get him for free. He can probably write his own ticket if he leaves. The one other thing I want to say is Roma have that they've offered him a deal that pays him something in the region of 180 grand a week. So anybody who wants him would not just, they wouldn't just have to beat that. They'd have to beat that by a very big margin. That's all we've got time for this week, but you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, and of course our web chats. Mine is on Tuesdays. Rory, you've done one. You might even be asked to do another one at some point in the near future, right?
You never know.
You never know.
If there's no one else available.
If there's nobody else available. That's the spirit. And of course, most of us are on Twitter. Matt, you're on Twitter too. What's your handle?
I am. At Matt Holland 8.
At Matt Holland 8. Wonder how you came up with that. Rory, you're on Twitter too, as am I, but people already know that. Till next week, bye-bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.